are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right On Radio, Dave Fedig will be talking with Ron Nirin, author of The Book of Lost Light, a novel that explores family, loyalty, betrayal, Finnish folklore, the nature of time, and what it takes to rise from tragedy. Nirin has published many short stories, including a number that were shortlisted for O. Henry Awards and Pushcart Prizes. He writes and teaches writing in the San Francisco Bay Area. In the last part of the hour, we'll be featuring an interview from the past with our special surprise legacy interview. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio. Mr. Fedig, can you hear me?
I can hear you. I can hear you.
Okay, good. Oh, here is Ron coming on the show.
Wait, somebody's here.
Here is Ron coming on the show.
Hi, Ron.
Hi, David.
Welcome to Right On Radio on KFAI.
So glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. The sun's still shining, so you are out west.
I am, although this background you see behind me on Zoom is a photograph of earlier in the day. So
okay.
A little time switching for you.
Well done. You fooled me. Welcome to the show, Ron. And Ron, your last name pronunciation, please?
Nirin.
Nirin. Okay. Thank you. Congratulations on the book. It's The Book of Lost Light, a novel. I wonder if we could begin, Ron, before we have a little reading from you to give us a sense for the story and your style. I greatly enjoyed it. Give us a description, if you could, Ron, the sweep of the novel. It's a historical novel. Give us a sense for what's happening before you give us a reading.
Yeah, The Book of Lost Light is the story of Joseph Kylander, a boy who grows up in early 20th century San Francisco, raised by his obsessive photographer father, who's trying to capture the passage of time and understand the mystery of time. And he's also raised by his impulsive older cousin, Karelia, who is a photographer in her own right, but very different in philosophy from his father. And it chronicles their lives before, during, and after the 1906 earthquake, after which they take refuge with a capricious patron and a group of rowdy artists in a backyard in Berkeley.
That's a great description. And it's just a great introduction for our listeners to all that goes on in this story. The characters are lively. The story keeps moving. I just had a blast reading it. And in these times, it was great to escape from 2020 and head back into a previous time. So Ron, let's begin with the reading. What do you have in mind for us?
Sure. Thank you. This passage is from early on in the book. It's 1905. Joseph is in his teens. And his older cousin, Karelia, is working as the receptionist for Arthur's photographic studio, where this takes place. And this is the moment they first meet Thomas Hallgarten, who will later become an important patron of Arthur's work. It was 7 minutes after five when someone knocked. I always knew precisely what time it was without needing to consult a clock, a skill I had learned to conceal from my schoolmates, since none of them seemed to possess it. Karelia called out, "We're closed for the day," but the knocking continued until I answered it. The man on the other side of the door stood well over 6 feet tall. He was perhaps in his early 40s, with a large oval head topped by fine, fair hair, and his stout frame fit snugly in a suit of gray cloth, which gave off the sweet odor of pipe tobacco. He said his name was Thomas Hallgarten. "Did you come to pick up prints?" I asked. "No," he said, gazing at the studio with eyes crinkled and curious. His hat dangled down from his fingertips, a style I'd never seen before, soft felt with a narrow brim that angled down in the front and turned up at the back. "Did you come to schedule a sitting?" I said. "We're usually booked in a week in advance, but there may be a cancellation." In fact, an alarming swath of my father's schedule was free these days. "I'll check the calendar for you." "I didn't come for a portrait," he said. Corelia came up behind me. She said, "You don't look like a creditor." The man laughed. "That's one thing I can be grateful for, then. Tell me, what do I look like?" She studied the mother-of-pearl cufflinks at his wrists, the gleaming black shoes. He wore four rings, one ornate and scrolled and set with tiny gems, the second bearing an amber-colored stone, the third thick and dark with the image of a dolphin stamped in the metal. The fourth was a simple gold band. "A gypsy violinist," she said. He grew solemn. "You have put your finger on it," he said. "I have the soul of a gypsy violinist, and yet I occupy the body of a businessman." "How sad for you," she said. "Better that than the soul of a businessman in the body of a gypsy violinist. I'm here to see Arthur Kylander. He wrote me about a project of his."
Thank you. That was Ron Nyren reading from his new novel, The Book of Lost Light. I love that passage. It's got a lot of the main themes I would love to discuss, and if we have all the time in the world, and we don't, speaking of time. And one of those themes is time. The others are photography, family, relationships, and so on. Let's begin with photography, Ron. Where did you come up with this idea? And tell us about the degree to which you are true to the history of photography when you are describing the early days. It's fascinating. I think readers will just really enjoy this discussion. I know Edward Muybridge and his famous horse photos. But talk to us about the inspiration for this novel and why photography plays the predominant role it does.
Yeah, well, I was working on a short story many years ago, set in contemporary times. There was a photographer who was a minor character, and he was photographing a boy regularly. And the story didn't work, but I kept thinking something about that was compelling, and I didn't know why or what it meant, why it mattered. And then I remembered the photography of Edward Muybridge, this pioneering man who captured in the 1870s the first images of a horse in motion. And he went on to photograph many animals in ways that people had never seen them moving, caught in the midst of striding before. And I was kind of fascinated by that. And I wondered, well, what if you extended the period, you know, instead of photographing an animal every few seconds, what might be revealed if you photographed a person once a day, every day of their life over a longer period of time? What might be revealed about the secrets of time? And so I imagined this man photographing his son every day of his life. So that sent me back to reading about Edward Muybridge's life, and he's a fascinating character in his own right.
Yeah.
But I also wondered, okay, here's this very scientific documentary approach to photography. What else is going on at the time in photography? And I started reading about the California pictorialists, who had a totally different approach. They were arguing that photography was a fine art, and you know, it wasn't just a mechanical process. They were manipulating images using any technique under the sun, painting on them, etching them, dodging and burning. They were really trying to convey their own artistic visions using the medium of photography. And so I thought, well, there's got to be a character who's, you know, sort of the antithesis of Arthur, a woman who's a pictorialist photographer. And then the lightning really struck when I thought, oh, she's a member of the family. She's maybe a cousin who comes down.
Well, she's a fascinating character. I just loved her. Readers will love her and want to know more and more about her. Speaking of the discussion you just raised about photography and whether and to what degree it's art, there's a nice scene, as you know, you wrote it, in the camp, in the post-earthquake camp where these bohemian artists come to reside, about the nature of photography and whether it is actually art. I was going to ask you directly your view of that. So why don't I do that? Where do you land on that question?
Oh, completely. Yeah. I mean, this was way back in the early days when the work in the darkroom was just tremendous. They would spend hours in the day making these amazing photographs that today we could do much more easily with Photoshop or simple filters. But just the painstaking labor that went into crafting these fabulous photographs. There was a photographer based in Oakland around that time period, Ann Brigman, who would go out and take her camera on long hikes in the Sierras and photograph her friends and families and the occasional stranger, often in the nude in nature, almost integrated into trees and rocks and crags, and then come back to the studio and work and rework them and create these mystical but compelling landscapes that both feel like a painting and they feel like reality. And I thought that was just, she was a great inspiration for the character of Corellia.
Yeah, I can see that from your description. By the way, I should note to our listeners that this is a novel with a lot of discussion about photography and pictures, and there are no pictures in it. It's a novel, but I can tell you, you will have stark images in your mind of those photographs, and I have distinct images in my mind that are still with me. So they're well described, Ron. Kudos to you. It's kind of a love letter to photography, if you ask me. And you mentioned Kylander's attempt to capture time with his pictures every day. They weren't just photographs from an old brownie. It was some thing he constructed, a telescope. What in the world is a telescope, and why is it important in this story?
Yes, well, Arthur is trying to capture, after his wife dies in childbirth, giving birth to Joseph, he is completely flattened by this death, but comes up with this idea of photographing his son once every day, basically from infancy onward. And he begins just by having Corellia hold Joseph up to the camera once every day and photographing. But he becomes dissatisfied by the incompleteness of just photographing the front. So a few years in, he invents this device he calls the tetroscope.
Tetroscope, thank you.
Which can photograph the subject from four sides simultaneously. So it's four cameras arranged at each point of the compass and all connected by tubes and mirrors so that the image from each camera lens ends up, each one ends up in a row on the negative. So with a record of the front, back, and both sides at the same time. So he gets this instantaneous photo of almost the whole body to compare over the years.
Yeah, fascinating. And he's quite obsessed with it. It makes me wonder if Arthur is a mad genius or just mad. And I'm sure we're left to wonder about that for ourselves. He's quite the character. We could talk a lot about him, but we're not going to get a chance to talk about. Let's talk about Corellia. Where did she come from? You mentioned the connection to the existing photographer. Was she inspired wholly from that? I mean, she just sort of appears beautifully and kind of takes over the story and helps move things along. Where did she come from in your imagination?
Yeah, well, I certainly Ann Brigman was a vital and eccentric and wonderful person from what I read about her life. She was just bold, her own independent woman. She would go running every morning, every Sunday morning on the beach in barefoot on these pebbly beaches. She would go hiking on her own, at a time when women were less likely to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So she just had a fierceness that inspired Corellia. But also there were other women photographers at the time who were doing similar kinds of very creative things. Berkeley photographers, Adelaide Hanscom Leeson, who created an illustrated edition of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, and other photographers who had, to make art at that time, to sort of dedicate your life to art as a woman, especially those who were married, took a certain degree of fierceness and inventiveness to pull off. And I just read a lot about women photographers of the time and the ways they forged new paths, I thought.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And speaking of characters, there's a book that plays a strong role, and that's the Kalevala. I hope I'm saying that right. This collection of Finnish mythic creation stories, I guess, or creation myths. Fascinating to learn about. I didn't know anything about this. And there are some pretty, I was going to say something impolite, like whacked out creation myths out there in the world. But there are some amazing stories in this book, and they show up in your novel. Where did that come from? And I can see some parallels. I've tried to, and I have to read the book again to do this in a detailed sort of way, but parallels between some of these creation myths that we got from the Kalevala and what's going on in the story. But tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I thought that when I started to think, where did Joseph's family come from? And my own family background is Swedish American mostly. My great grandparents on three sets of my great grandparents immigrated from Sweden. So I could have gone that route, but I had this perverse desire to make this novel not autobiographical as much as possible. So instead I said, well, maybe they're Finnish. I grew up enamored by the short stories of and the novels of Tove Jansson, the Finnish author, of the Moomin Troll books, most famously, but many other amazing books for adults as well. But she was, too contemporary to be available to put in the book. So the only other thing I knew about Finland was the Kalevala, which I knew very little of. I read about it in an encyclopedia of old myths as a child. And so I went back to it. Mm-hmm. I actually read the whole thing, and it's this fascinating, bizarre epic poem that outside of Finland is not as known as well as it should be. It has the story of this ancient wizard, Wainamoinen, who has various adventures battling the queen of the north and being unlucky in love. And it's this concatenation of oral folktales put together by Elias Lönnrot. Mm-hmm. So once I started to read this book, I was just like, oh, this is, more people have to know about this. And it just captivated my imagination. And I thought, well, maybe the characters, Joseph is going to grow up to be a sort of a theatrical person, I figured, given his tendency to be in front of the camera every day. So right. I thought, well, maybe after the earthquake, people at the time were putting on their own amateur theatricals. So maybe they would be performing stories from the Kalevala. And I didn't really anticipate that there would be parallels between the Kalevala stories and my own book. That was never part of my agenda. But after I finished it, I looked back and I thought, well, actually, there are certain parallels that just sort of fell into place.
Yeah, that's beautiful when that happens. If you force it, it doesn't always work, right? Going back to the excerpt that you read, and you also reference Greek myths in the book, and I was thinking about this afterwards, Karelia could be representative of, to a certain degree, some of these femme fatale characters that show up in these various stories, and, Mr. Hallgarden be a sort of a, I don't know, descending sort of godlike character that comes in and messes things up, if you will, or causes things to happen. At any rate, that's my clumsy way of saying nice job of giving us these different layered stories. I thought it was beautifully done.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's talk about the earthquake. Even though we all know about the earthquake, I wasn't ready for it when it happened. I was just as shocked and surprised and disrupted as the characters were. So it was sort of a nice effect. Spoiler alert, there's an earthquake, everyone, in San Francisco. I really enjoyed that. It helped me feel like I learned more about the earthquake. But this idea that these particular characters would end up in a makeshift camp in the Hallgarten's property and then start putting on plays, I thought was kind of a magical sort of a Midsummer Night's Dream sort of thing happening.
Is there any basis in reality for those kinds of things happening, or is this just out of Ron Niren's head?
I wish I had come up with it, but actually it is inspired by, I was researching art of the time, I came across a paragraph about a group of artists who camped out in the backyard of the novelist Herman Whittaker in Oakland. There was I kept looking for more about that, and I did eventually find an oral history of Herman Whittaker's daughter and an essay also, which gave a little bit more information. She was 17 at the time, and she and her brothers would collect firewood for the artists for the bonfire that they had out in the backyard. And eventually, a year later, she married one of the artists who was quite a number of years her senior, and they were a fascinating pair. Xavier Martinez, a tonalist painter whose paintings were somewhat reminiscent of the photography of the pictorialists, sort of very atmospheric and imbued with feeling. So it was inspired by that, and I wanted to know more about what happened around that bonfire. And since I couldn't find more, I made it up.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating, and the Hall Gardens are an interesting family. Tell us a little more about them and how they complicate things. And Thomasine, am I pronouncing her name correctly?
Yes,
Thomasine. I was fascinated by her also, but please, I'll turn it over to you.
Yes. Well, Thomas becomes the patron of Arthur. He's been searching for a patron in much the same way that Muybridge was helped immensely when Governor Stanford became his patron and funded the photography of so many animals. So once I had a patron, I started to think of sort of the dangers of relying on a patron, a wealthy man and an artist, what could go wrong? And just as things went wrong with Stanford and Muybridge, I thought things could get hairy with Mr. Hallgarden. So without giving too much away, I'll say the families do become somewhat embroiled, and Joseph does develop a pretty big crush on Mr. Hallgarden's daughter, which has ramifications later on in the book. But I also just love portraying a Berkeley family of the time, because Berkeley was full of a very bohemian attitude, integrating life with nature and following certain nature-based philosophies that I just found fascinating and wanted to put in the book.
Yeah, yeah. Thomasine reminds me, I marked, among the many passages I marked, when she's told that she shouldn't tell anyone about the tetrascope and the project, she said, "Oh, I see," she said dryly. "You're afraid someone will see this and photograph their own child for 14 years." It's a great comment, and it's kind of an idea in the back of the reader's mind, like, why is this guy so obsessed with this project, and really, what is he trying to do? I thought these characters really come alive, I was eager to always sit down every day and read and catch up with what they're doing. We're speaking with Ron Niren. We're getting dangerously close to the end of our half hour. I can't believe it, Ron. I want to ask you about what you're up to next. But before I do that, the choice you made to have the story told by Joseph, the son, that from that point of view, it's a big decision for an author to make, telling a story like this. Why did you choose that? And that can be limiting in your ability to tell the story, because Joseph has to either know about what's going on or show up and all that sort of thing. So as a writing instructor, tell the class why you chose this.
Yes, that's a great question. I started writing this book not knowing whose point of view it would be in, and I tried three different approaches, two of them third person, and one of them Joseph, and Joseph started telling about events that happened long before he was born. And I thought, well, that's weird, but there's a certain vitality to that voice that I gave the three openings, the three sort of very different openings to my spouse and writing partner, Sarah Stone, and without telling her my favorite. And she said, "Oh, this first person one, that's great, go with that." And so that's mashed my own feeling. And it did cause some headaches because when you ever do a first person, especially with a large cast, you have to figure out how does this person know what happened before they were born? How do you indicate to the reader when they're imagining it based on what little they know? And how do they learn things that happen outside their purview? So it took some time to figure these things out. And many times you can leave it a mystery, and as long as it's clear that it's a mystery to the narrator and they wish they knew too, or they could speculate about what might have gone on, and then the reader feels like, oh, okay, I have some plausible theories to go with.
Now that's a really great point. So we're with him trying to figure things out. Yeah, that's right. And it does happen. And I was consciously thinking about this because, you know, that's the task of what we try to do here. But it works such that it doesn't get in the way of the story at all.
That's great to hear.
Yeah, we really grow to like the guy. He feels like a trustworthy narrator, I think.
Yes, he is. I love the unreliable narrator technique, but ultimately, in this case, it seemed to be a reliable narrator was the way to go.
Yeah, so let's talk about what you're up to next. And by the way, congrats on the short stories also. You've had a fine writing career to this point. Are we going to hear more from these guys, or you have another novel in the works?
Yes, I have short stories, some of them historic, some of them contemporary, in the works. And I also have a novel inspired in part by one of the Greek myths that Joseph and his fellow artists perform in this book. But this next novel, as I'm envisioning it, will be a retelling of that myth in ancient Greek times.
Oh, so you're going into the Wayback Machine.
This going is way back.
Real historic novel. So for writing historic novels, tell us about how much time you spend. Time is up. Well, we're not going to do that. I just got the heads up. So, Ron, I'm going to wrap things up with that. It's been great chatting with you. It went so fast. The novel is The Book of Lost Light, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great read. You'll get lost in that world, and that's what you need to do in these days, believe me. His name is Ron Nyren, N-Y-R-E-N. Look him up. Ron, it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Yeah. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
And
happy
best
2021.
To you. Thank you much. And now, this.
Before he was called a wonderling, he had many names: Shuttlehead, Plonker, Groundling, and Spike, among others. He didn't mind these much, not even Groundling. The name he truly disliked was the first he ever remembered being called, Number 13. It wasn't a name, really, just a number written in red on a piece of paper, filed in a drawer in a room full of hundreds of files and drawers. It was embossed on a small tin medallion attached to a piece of cord he wore around his neck at a home for unclaimed creatures. It was sewn inside his tattered gray shirt and shabby gray trousers, and it was painted on his hard, narrow bed in a room full of the beds of other unclaimed creatures who had at least been fortunate enough to have been given the gift of birth. He looked like a young fox, but stood upright like a child, and had no tail to speak of. His eyes were a lovely chestnut brown and flecked with gold. But there was something about them that gave one the sense that although he had not been in this world very long, he carried within him some inexplicable sorrow. He was a creature with an innocent heart. What kind of creature, though? Who could say? Despite his fox kit face, his snout was more dog than fox. And there was something rabbity about him, too, in the way his nose twitched when he sensed danger, and how he trembled when he heard the loud clang of the orphanage bell. But the most singular thing about him was that he had only one ear.
Very good. You've been listening to Mira Bartok reading from her new children's novel, The Wonderling. She is the author of numerous books, including The Memory Palace, a memoir, which won the 2011 National Book Critics Circle Award for Autobiography. And The Wonderling, I understand, is going to be made into a film, so that's great, too. Mira Bartok, welcome to Write on Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about the story. I mean, it's sort of, in many ways, a fantasy homage to Oliver Twist, I guess.
Well, it's a kind of a mashup of several things.
Yeah,
definitely I was influenced by Dickens and the world he created, particularly Oliver Twist, but there are other other influences in there too. But there are also, I was definitely influenced by the classic classic children's stories and young adult stories like Lord of the Rings and and obviously the Narnia books and by C.S. Lewis and so I wanted to have this to have a classic feel.
Yeah.
But it's a world that feels kind of Victorian England during the Industrial Revolution, which is a time in England that, as well as United States and other places, that seems to resonate with a lot of the things that are going on now in our world. But it definitely is a fantasy.
Yeah. So we start off with him, with Arthur, who you talk about as number 13 and who later gets the name Arthur, in this orphanage.
Right. He's in this horrible place that is called Miss Carbuncle's Home for Wayward and Misbegotten Creatures, and it's run by our villainess named Miss Carbuncle, who has a very mysterious history of her own, and you find out a lot more about her throughout the book, and she will definitely be in book two, which I'm in the middle of writing right now. She has a 2.5 foot high bright orange wig, which she is concealing something underneath, which I won't tell you about. You have to read the book. But she is sort of an example of someone who had a lot of disappointment in early life, and that transformed into bullying and general bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
She's very much a kind of dictator sort of character.
Yeah.
But he does escape. That's not a spoiler. It's on the cover of the book, so everyone knows. Arthur escapes, number 13 escapes, and sets off to find his destiny.
Yeah.
And goes on a lot of adventures.
So in many ways, it's a coming of age story, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, he turns 11 in the beginning of the book, and I love that age because, and I like writing for that age a lot. I think, you're not concerned about hormones and romance, really. You're really concerned about, who the main characters are, who am I in the world? And everything is so wondrous and, and who are my friends and why am I here? And, he asks all these questions, and those are the kind of questions I remember asking myself when I was 11.
Sure. Where did the inspiration for him come from? And was it was there any one person that a nephew or something, or was it just sort of a conglomeration, or was it just sort of an idealized 11-year-old in your mind?
A combination. I think the character in some ways is a lot like I was when I was 11. Mm-hmm. I was pretty shy and had certain gifts, but I was afraid to share them. So it's there's a little bit of me in there, but also, I often start writing about a character, through drawing, just random drawing and sketching whatever comes to my mind, or being out in the world and sketching, particularly sketching animals. And so my character started out as a sketch, and I wasn't even thinking about who this character was. I just started sketching, and I made a drawing of actually a one-eared rabbit, which turned into a fox dog-like creature that looks somewhat like my own dog, Sadie. She's black, but she has these giant ears, and I also wanted a character that had a lot of folk tales. There's a lack and a gain, and in this case, it seems like my character would have. He only has one ear. He doesn't know why he's born. Was he born that way? Did he lose it in some way? So he has this lack. But yet he has this incredible gift
right.
that you find out about that he uses his ear for. Right. And
yeah, I don't think it's giving too much away to talk about that. But I mean, if you don't want to, we certainly don't have to. But it is sort of often the case that when we lose something, a sense of smell, a sense of taste, a sense of hearing, or whatever, we gain. We don't necessarily gain on the other side, but we become much more attuned to those other senses and we're able to use them better. And so
Definitely.
So there's just sort of this compensatory process that nature seems to endow us with.
Yeah, I definitely see that with my dog. She's getting old and she's losing her sense of hearing and sight. So she's paying a lot more attention to the world with her nose, even though, of course, dogs do that.
Yeah.
She sniffs a lot more. She sniffs around to find things much more than she used to.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. And you mostly populate the story with these hybrid creatures. I mean, you talk a little bit about 13 Arthur, who is sort of a part fox, part person, and most of the characters, there's a few that are not, of course, but I mean, there are many within the story, but a few of the ones that you sort of focus on are not. But by and large, they're all these hybrids. Talk a little bit about the decision to do that.
I knew that I wanted to have animals in this book. And one of the really basic reasons was I enjoy drawing them so much more than I enjoy drawing people.
Mm.
And I'm just better at it. And I also love animals. And I used to work at a zoo. I spend a lot of time, as much as time as I can, you know, around animals. I visit a horse every day that lives down the road. I have a dog. I used to live on a farm with more animals. And so that was part of it. But also, I wanted there to be a kind of hierarchy. And in my world, and I knew that I'm not sure why I wanted to have an animal-human hybrid. I think it just sort of popped into my mind, and that's what happened. And I knew that I wanted there to be animals, and then these animal-human hybrids that are called groundlings, and then the humans. But also there are other creatures that are creatures of ancient magic that right. appear. And those, we learn a little bit more about them in book two, and they, some of them transform into other things.
Mm.
And so there's definitely this hierarchy, and the humans really dominate these groundlings and treat them poorly. So I think that it's just part of this class system I created. They're not supposed to be, you know, specifically supposed to represent any group of people that exist, you know, in our world, other than just think of anyone who is treated poorly in our society, and they can be a groundling.
Yeah. Right. And you also did all the illustrations yourself as well. You talk about loving to draw and so forth. This book kind of reminded me a little bit of the Monster Blood Tattoo series, and particularly Lamplighter by D.M. Cornish.
I don't know those. Wait a minute. I have to write those down.
Oh, okay.
The Monster Blood
Tattoo series, yeah.
Okay.
One of the books, the only one that I got to interview him for the show was called Lamplighter, which was book two in the series.
Okay.
And it's essentially a very similar story in some ways, this young orphan.
Oh.
And he does all his own illustrations. He's an author illustrator. I think he's Australian, and it was a number of years ago we had him on the show. But he had, it's been so many years, I can't recall, maybe 100 pages of illustrations that he had put forth, and then he had to cull from them for the book, you know, and didn't use all that many within the text itself. But it was just interesting to talk to somebody who was able to do illustrations as well as writing, because in children's literature, that's pretty rare. Was that something was that something that you knew right off the bat you're going to be able to do this, or did you have to talk to your publisher and say, I want to be allowed to do this, or?
Normally with children's books, and this is true with, when people are, they're writing their first picture book, say picture books for, you know, younger children. Mm-hmm. The rule is don't illustrate your own book. A newbie writer always feels like they have to turn in illustrations too to get it accepted. And that's like the worst thing to do, because usually one of those things you do better.
Yeah.
But that is true that middle grade authors rarely illustrate their own work. That's very, I didn't realize that was so unusual, but it is. In this case, when my agent submitted my manuscript, which was only about a quarter of the way done, I had done some finished illustrations, and she submitted those as well.
Okay.
Because she felt that they were as strong and they were integral to the book. And when my publisher saw them, she and the art director really loved them, and that was definitely part of the book deal. They automatically wanted me to illustrate the book too. And the movie was actually sold partially because of these images. The movie agents who initially happened to see my manuscript, which was a total fluke. It was just one of those weird moments where someone's in the right place at the right time. my agent is crazy. I mean, this stuff doesn't happen. It's just weird. My agent was in a meeting at in LA for another project for another client, and she happened to have my manuscript opened up on her laptop at this meeting at CAA, which is Creative Artists Agency, the big movie agency, and she had my one of my illustrations of Arthur right there, and the movie agents happened to pass by and said, "What's that?"
Mm.
And it was based on that drawing.
Wow.
To answer your question roundabout way, it is very unusual. I didn't know if they were going to let me illustrate it or not.
Yeah.
But that was just a given. That was immediately, it was immediately a green light. I also had like this author you're talking about. I also had a lot more of illustrations that didn't get into the book because they're just, it's a big book.
Yeah.
It's really kind of fat and turned out to be longer than I anticipated.
Right.
So, and we ended up ditching some of those big illustrations and just, I ended up making a bunch of little spot illustrations to fit in spaces.
Yeah, well, that's sort of more common with this age of reader anyway, I think. You don't see as many of the bigger illustrations. So, well, let's listen, if we can, to another passage from the book.
Okay, then. Let's see here. Let me find a page. I think I'll read... this is a little section when you learn about his special gift.
Okay.
And he is number 13, who will become Arthur, is in the dining hall at the home, this horrible orphanage. And he's sitting down, and he's very, very shy. Anyway, he's just sort of sitting there eating his cold porridge. The one-eared orphan longed for companionship, but whenever he gathered the courage to approach someone, he spoke so softly and stuttered so much that it was hard to understand him. Some of the groundlings, not to mention the headmistress and Mr. Sneezeweed, her assistant, treated him as though he were deaf. How could that stammering creature called number 13 possibly hear with just one pathetic ear? But he was listening. He was listening to everything around him. If he concentrated hard enough and went to a quiet, secret place inside himself, he could sometimes hear extraordinary things. He could hear the secret movements of insects busy at their work beneath the floorboards and inside the walls, and he wondered if they could hear him too. He could hear the old donkey in the stables softly braying itself to sleep at night, and the two carriage horses swatting flies with their tails in summer. He had never seen them, but he knew they were there. And in winter, he could even hear snow falling in the courtyard. The worst weather produced the loveliest of sounds. Whoosh, whoosh. And he wondered if this was a kind of song, this melody of snow. And if by chance in spring a bird, small and delicate of wing, was singing in the tree outside the wall, number 13 could hear her clear as a bell from inside the home. He could hear the quiet snap of every twig, the gentle flutter of her wings as she flew from branch to branch. Loveliest of all, he could hear her tender nesting song as she soared through the air to her new home. And when he did, her song filled him with such unbearable longing, he thought his swollen heart would burst.
Very good. That is Mira Bartok reading from her new children's novel, The Wonderling. And you're listening to Right on Radio on KFAI. One of the things that I found interesting was the importance of music. I mean, you talk about it much more later in the book than you do earlier in the book, because earlier in the book you're sort of telling us who these people are and what's going on, but then it becomes much more important as the book progresses, and I imagine will be very important in book two as well.
Yes. My character, you know, he lives in this place until he escapes, where music is forbidden, and the worst crime of all is to sing. And yet, in his sleep, he starts singing. He can't help himself, and you learn more about that as time goes on, and more about his musical gifts, and the you know, the book is called The Wonderling, but the subtitle is Song Catcher, which is a machine that contains the most beautiful music and songs and sounds in the world. And that becomes a really important sort of wondrous device that number 13/Arthur discovers. And yes, music is so important, and expressing oneself and the and our young hero's imagination, which has been stifled in this place. And it definitely is important in book two. The book two is called Singing Tree, and music takes on a whole other power in a kind of a larger way. I can't give anything away,
but no.
definitely there's music, and a couple of the characters, you know, like there's one character is very much like a combination of Fagin and the Artful Dodger named Quintus.
Right.
He's always making up songs, singing music, very important.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking about that as I was coming up with questions, that I was trying to decide if Quintus was more like Fagin or more like the Artful Dodger, and I just decided he was a combination of the both of them.
Right.
And one of the other things that you do is you've created this world, of course. You've got Lumentown and Gloomentown and this whole world, but you kept the Arthurian legend, the Arthurian mythology. And I was curious about the decision-making process. You know, what led you to decide to keep certain elements of our past mythology and at the same time create this completely different sort of world? Was it just a fascination with that particular story?
I think that... this may sound really silly because I wasn't raised with TV, so I kind of miss a lot of cultural cues. And I live in a small town, and we, a very rural area, in a very rural area where we don't have high-speed internet. Hmm. And so whatever I watch, I either, you know, get DVD movies or once in a while I'll get a television series. And I discovered this television series that was on this, I guess, Sci-Fi channel a while back called Merlin.
Oh.
It's with the Irish young actor Colin Morgan plays young Merlin. It's a fantasy, and it's mm-hmm. about if Merlin was young, not this old bearded dude wizard, and he gets to know young Arthur as a young man before he becomes a king, what would happen? And I fell in love with the series, and I fell in love in particular with the young Merlin. And I watched the show, all the episodes before I wrote The Wonderling. And that's kind of what made me decide to mess around with the Arthurian legend, because they take various Arthurian tropes in the show, and they just play with them and do really interesting things. And there are many ways to tell the story, but I think that what captivated me was the idea of this character who is pure of heart, and who, you know, kind of like a babe character, who because of his innocence and his goodness, his essential goodness, he's able to transform situations. He's able to do good things, you know, amazing things. You know, of course, you don't see his sort of power as much until you see that more in book two, let's say.
Yeah.
But in this television series, Merlin was that kind of character, and that just and seeing that series, I think, reminded me of all those books and movies that I loved, where there is this character who saves the day, not necessarily by fighting, you know, and having a big battle with people, you know, being a kind of warrior character, but rather someone who sings.
Yeah.
World,
well, it was
who touches our hearts.
Yeah, it was great. We're out of time, so we're going to have to leave it at that. But I really liked it, and I look forward to seeing reading book two as well when that comes out. This is Steve McKellistrom speaking with Mira Bartok about her new children's novel, The Wonderling. Mira Bartok, thanks for being on Right on Radio.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks so much. Yeah. It's great to be here.
All right, great. And now this.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our guest tonight, Ron Nieren, plus our listeners who make this show possible. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/program/Right on Radio, plus listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast found on Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now, stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.